We come to our final study in the book of Ezekiel, and tonight chapters 40 to 48. It's a fitting climax to the book, and indeed a fitting climax to the whole drama that we have seen here in this book. The destruction of Jerusalem, the people in captivity, but then the prospect of a new era, the prospect of the return to their homeland and the reconstruction of their nation, the reconstruction of their religion. And Ezekiel now pictures that glorious climax in these last nine chapters. And it finishes with the magnificent picture of God dwelling among his people. Now the language, the illustrations that Ezekiel uses are of a nature that the people of his time would understand. He spoke of things that they saw and things that they knew. In other words, he saw the new era in terms of a rebuilt temple and a rebuilt city. Remember that Ezekiel was a priest. He was a man who had a great concern for exactness of things. And that goes all the way through his book as he gives details of times and seasons and dates and happenings and a particular concern for the religion of Israel. The ideal life that he's looking forward to as they go back into the land is a life with God at the very center of the nation. That's the essence of this section. God is at the center of things. And he sees it in terms of an ideal religious system with a temple and a religious order that is perfect in every detail. And then he sees it also in terms of a total political and civil arrangement in the ordinary everyday affairs of the people where everything is just and orderly. And that's in keeping with the frame of mind that our friend Ezekiel has. Again, it's symbolism. It's presenting truth by means of pictures and symbols and illustrations. And I hope that if we've learned nothing else from Ezekiel, at least we've understood that much of his book. That's the way he gets his message across, and once again, that's what he's doing. He is speaking of spiritual realities, but he's using these symbolic pictures to do it. So when we look at this book, these last nine chapters in particular, we're not to get bogged down with architectural details. The first, I think it's about four chapters, he's going to talk about the temple. And then the next four or five chapters, he's going to talk about the land and the division of the land. But we don't want to think that all he's talking for is to give us details of architecture or details of land surveying. It's the spiritual truths which are behind these things which are the important issues. And I believe that just as those things taught the people of his day the basic issues that God was concerned about, so they can teach us today some of the basic issues that we as God's people today should be concerned about. Really, what it's concerned about is the quality of life that God wants in his people. We'll now go to chapter 40, and we'll look firstly in chapters 40 to 44 at the temple which he sees in vision. The opening verse tells us that it's now 14 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. It's the 25th year, in fact, of his exile. Jerusalem has now been in ruins 14 years, and so time is moving on. In verse 2, we see that he was brought in the visions of God back into the land of Israel. We saw this once before when he was picked up by the hair and transported, as it were, into Jerusalem. Well, here again, that is what happens in verse 2. He sits down on a high mountain, and there he sees before him this perfect plan for the reconstruction of Israel. Perfect plan for a temple, perfect plan for a division of the nation, and the operation of its civil and religious affairs. He goes then to describe the temple in great detail, three chapters of it in fact. He starts off in verse 5 by telling us that there was a wall all around the outside of the temple. And that's the first thing we notice, that the wall was there around the temple to separate the temple from the unclean things in the world outside. The next three chapters give us the details concerning the temple, and I don't intend going into those details. If you want to follow them through, I have set them out in some detail in the book, together with a plan and all sorts of references and data there, which I think will help you to understand the three chapters fairly simply. When you get to the end of those three chapters, and incidentally the three chapters deal with the construction of the temple, where the inner court was, the outer court, how many doors there were, where the priests worked, where the people came together, where they worshipped, where the king sat when he worshipped, how big the wall was, the cloisters around the outside, the little rooms for the priests, the kitchens where they prepared the food for sacrifices. All the details are there, if you want them, in those three chapters. And at the end of those three chapters, in the last verse of chapter 42, he measured it on the four sides and found it was square, indicating the perfection of the whole thing, a perfect square. It had a wall round about it, 500 cubits long and 500 cubits broad. A cubit, incidentally, is about half a meter. And it was to make a separation between the holy and the common. And that's the important clause, the very last clause there, to make a separation between the holy and the common. The temple of God is holy, and the things of God are holy. And Ezekiel wants these people to realize that they are to be kept clean from the unclean things which are in the world round about us. I'll come back to that in a moment as we look at one of the New Testament applications of this. But I want to get on to chapter 43. You will remember that 19 years earlier, Ezekiel had seen a vision, going back to chapters 8, 9, 10, 11. And in that vision, God, in his chariot throne, had been in the temple of Jerusalem, and then he had moved out to the outer gate, and then he had moved outside the city, and then he went across the valley and up onto the mountain. God departed, and subsequent to that, the city was destroyed. God no longer dwelt there. God no longer protected it. Now, restoration is to take place. The people are to go back. The city is to be rebuilt, and God is going to come and dwell among them again. And that is pictured in chapter 43. Here we have this vision of the Lord now as he returns to the city by the same route as he left, and he fills the temple with his glory. And so God dwells among his people, and he tells them not to defile the temple again. Chapter 43, verse 1. He brought me to the gate facing east. And behold, the glory of the Lord of Israel came from the east, and the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters, and the earth shone with his glory. And the vision I saw was like the vision which I had seen when he came to destroy the city, back in chapter 9. Remember the man with the carrying case and the six executioners, and they went and destroyed the city? Well, that's what he refers to here. He says, the vision that I saw was like the vision I saw when he destroyed the city. And it was also like the vision I saw at the river in chapter 1, the vision of the chariot throne. In other words, what is happening here is that that chariot throne is coming back into the city from which it had previously departed. Verse 4, as the glory of the Lord entered the temple, and that's the important thing, the glory of the Lord enters the temple as God takes up his dwelling among his people once more. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, that's the heavenly guide, I heard one speaking to me out of the temple, and he said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet, where I will dwell in the midst of the people of Israel forever. And the house of Israel shall no more defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings by their harlotry, on by their other wicked deeds which he talks about in the following verses. God says, I'm going to come back here. This is my dwelling place. Learn the lessons of history and don't defile this place again. And so that more or less summarizes the vision that Ezekiel had of the rebuilt temple. Then in verse 10, he is told to go and describe all this to the house of Israel, describe the temple and its appearance and its plan, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities. You see the point? He's not to describe the temple and its plan simply so they can all be architects and builders and understand those details. He said there's a spiritual meaning to this so that they will understand the implications of this holy temple of God and what is required of them. All of this was something of an illustrated sermon. It was a practical demonstration. It was an object lesson to them of the holiness that God required and the worship which he demanded from them in purity and holiness. Verse 11, and if they are ashamed of all that they have done, portray the temple, its arrangements, its exits, its entrances, its whole form, everything. He says, make known to them its ordinances, its laws. Write it down in their sight so that they may observe and perform all its laws and all its ordinances. We all know that Israel always looked for the golden age. If you understand anything at all from the Old Testament, you'll always understand that. That all the way through the Psalms and the prophets, they always look to that great era, the golden age when the Messiah would rule. We find here again the national hope of the people is uplifted by the words of Ezekiel. But Ezekiel has said time and time again that the fact that the nation is to get these blessings is no guarantee that the individuals are going to experience them. He said time and again that the individuals who sin will suffer God's judgment. And we know that in spite of the national restoration of Israel, the individual failure was still at a very high level. It was only ever the faithful remnant who truly believed. And you find as you come to the New Testament that the Messiah does come. Jesus Christ comes in fulfillment of all the promises. And when he comes, they reject him. As a whole, the nation said, "We don't want this man to reign over us." But not all of them rejected him. There were the few, the faithful few, Matthew, John, Peter, James, Andrew, and so it goes on. And these faithful Jews were the believers. And the faithful remnant of the old nation became the nucleus of the new people of God. And those men, as they went out and took the message, they saw other Jews converted in the early chapters of Acts. 3,000 of them, in fact. And it went beyond the Jews as you get on into Acts, and you find there were Gentiles as well. And they all came in. And so the numbers started to increase once again. And Paul writes of this great multitude as the people who were from above, born from above, the Jerusalem which is above. Also he says that they are a temple, and we are part of that temple. Now that's not exactly the temple that Ezekiel was talking about, but I'm just using this to show the application that we can make. Because when you come to the New Testament, we indeed are a temple of God, and he dwells among us. And this is what Paul said to the Corinthians. He says, "Do you not know that you are God's temple, that is you as a community of believers, as a church, are God's temple, and God's Spirit dwells in you? If anyone destroys God's temple, if anybody messes up the church, destroys it through the division and things that were happening in Corinth, then God will destroy him, because God's temple is holy." As we saw in Ezekiel, God's temple is holy. And that temple, you are. And then he goes on a little bit in his second letter, and he says something the same. He says, "We are the temple of the living God. Therefore, come out from among them and be separate from them, says the Lord, and touch nothing unclean." You see, the separation was made between the unclean and the clean. The wall was around the temple to separate the holy things of God from the unclean world outside. Now, says Paul, once again, realize that the temple of God in which you dwell, of which you are a part, is holy and it's clean. Be separate from these unclean things, touch nothing unclean, and then I will welcome you and I will be to you a father. And then he goes on writing to the Ephesians and he says something the same. He says, "We are built upon the foundations of the apostles and prophets. Jesus Christ is the chief cornerstone. And in him the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple to the Lord, in whom you also are built into it for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." Ezekiel, go and describe this house of the Lord to them. The temple, its appearances, its functions, its plan. Portray it to them, its ordinances and its laws, so that they might be holy, so that they might understand me, my glory, my requirements, and that they may not defile the temple of God. We come also to speak of the land, that is the land of Israel as it was to be divided according to this vision which Ezekiel had. Now I'll put on this transparency and just point out a few features. All of this is symbolic. It is all teaching things by means of symbols and illustrations. And the way the land was to be divided was very mechanical. Notice that it was divided so that all 12 tribes had an equal portion. Now, you can draw that sort of thing very simply on a piece of paper, but you can't survey a country and divide the country up like that. Not a country of hills and valleys and ravines and streams, as was Israel. It was absolutely impossible to divide the place into 12 tribes according to that sort of arrangement. But it was a symbolic presentation. That God wanted justice, and God says all the tribal areas are to be equal. No favoritism anymore. 7 were to be in the northern section, 5 in the southern section, and in the portion in between, there was a section where the king and all the religious things were to be grouped. In the center of that was what was called the holy portion plus the portion for the city. And this was to be given to the Levites and the priests, that is the holy portion, and then the portion for the city was for the city. And on either side of that was a portion for the king. And then north of it, 7 tribes, and south of it, 5 tribes, equal in area. You can see that's a very, very stylized presentation, but the purpose was to point out to the people the perfection and honesty and justice and the concentration of the things of God in the center of their nation. As I say, in practice it wouldn't work out that way. But Ezekiel's not there as a surveyor or as an architect. It's not literal things he's talking about. It's a symbolic presentation so that they'll get a few facts. Going to enlarge that central portion. See that central portion there of the king's land on either side of that central square? And it blows up like this. I'm not going to get bogged down into all the details here. If you read the mathematics of this through, you'll have yourself quite some fun. It's not nearly as complicated as you might imagine. And in fact, I've given this sort of drawing in the book, and I've also put out various dimensions and things so that it can be traced through. Let me just point out the basic features of this. Let's take that central portion to start with. At the very center of it was the temple, marked on the map by a T. And the temple was in the center of the area given to the priests. North of that was an area given to the Levites. The priests were the ones who carried out the functions in the temple, and the Levites were the religious assistants. And south of the priests' area was a smaller area given to the city. Put together, the whole lot made a square, 25,000 cubits square. If you like to look at chapter 45, you'll find that what I've got on that diagram is in fact what the Bible says. You shall allot the land as a possession. You shall set apart for the Lord a portion of the land as a holy district, and it shall be 25,000 cubits by 20,000. That is, the holy district consists of the land for the Levites and the land for the priests put together. Verse 2, of this, a square plot of 500 by 500 cubits will be for the sanctuary, the temple, with 50 cubits around as an open space. That was a further way of separating the holy things of God from the everyday things outside. So there's the wall, and then a further 25-meter open space around the outside of the wall. Verse 3, in the holy district you shall measure off a section 25,000 cubits by 10,000, in which shall be the sanctuary, the most holy place. It shall be the holy portion of the land. It shall be for the priests. In other words, the sanctuary was right there in the middle of the priest section. And then you go down to verse 5, and it says another section, equal in area, 25,000 by 10,000, is for the Levites. It's next door to the area for the priests. And then in verse 6, on the other side, south of the area for the priests, is the area for the city. That's in chapter 45, verse 6. Just notice that the temple is not in the city. Now, I have met people who haven't really understood the book of Ezekiel at all, but they get fascinated by these last number of chapters. And they seem to take a great interest in the mechanics of these things and talk about Ezekiel's temple being reconstructed in Jerusalem in the present day or sometime in the future. Well, whether the temple will be reconstructed in the future isn't a matter that we're going to decide from the book of Ezekiel. Because as far as Ezekiel is concerned, the temple is not in the city. And so if these people are talking about Ezekiel's temple being built in Jerusalem today, they're barking up the wrong tree. The whole point of Ezekiel's message is that the temple is in the center of the priest section, because the priests are the ones who look after the temple, and that's where it's to be located. And the city is to be kept in this other section to the south. In fact, if you work it out, you find they're several miles separate. You know, that's just by the way, but at least it might stop a few red herrings being dragged across the pathway. Concerning the section for the city, the southern section there, you notice that in the middle is a square part for the city itself, and then on either side is what we call land for the city. And later on we're going to find that that is described as being land for the production of produce, farmland, so that the people in the city could go out and farm their own land nearby in that area. Either side of that central portion is the land for the king, and it stretches to the Mediterranean Sea on one side and to the Jordan River on the other. The point of that is this. The Israelite kings in times past had the nasty habit of gobbling up the land that belonged to other people. So, God says, I am giving you this land. Don't go gobbling up the land of anybody else. That is for the king and for his family. If the king wants to give it to his son, or some portion of it to his son, then he may do so, because the son is part of the royal family, and so the inheritance stays within the royal family. But he must not take anybody else's land, and he must not give any of the king's land to the common people. There's to be a demarcation so that one does not encroach upon the other. And that was to make sure that the sorts of sins that we read about in the Old Testament don't recur. You see the whole symbolic feature. This is a good way of getting the message across. You go back to those kings in times past and you have Ahab and Jezebel, and they want Naboth's vineyard. Well, they've got enough land of their own, but they then trump up charges against Naboth, and so they seize his vineyard. Well, this sort of arrangement is going to stop that happening in the future. Ezekiel is looking for this ideal arrangement where the king and the common people and the religious people, the whole civil and religious setup is integrated perfectly so that they have the ideal life with God at the midst of the nation. If the king happened to give some of his land to one of his servants who was not of the royal family, then that servant could have the land until the year of Jubilee. Now, the year of Jubilee occurred every 50 years. And on that year, all land that had changed hands over the previous 50 years reverted to the original owner. If the king therefore gave it to one of the common people, when the Jubilee came, the land reverted to the king. But if the king gave it to his son or someone else in the royal family, when the 50th year came, it stayed with that son because it was still within the confines of the royal family. That's just another one of these details. But I think it's interesting, even though it's a very practical, mechanical sort of a statement, it shows us again that God is concerned for honesty and justice. And there are too many politicians, and sometimes they're church politicians, who have all sorts of tricks whereby they can manipulate numbers and manipulate figures and finances and programs and so on for their own ends at the expense of other people. Here's just a reminder that God is concerned that everything be clear-cut and open and honest. Chapter 45, verse 7 will describe some of these things I've just outlined. To the prince shall belong the land on both sides, you see, on both sides of the holy district and the property of the city. The holy district and the property of the city, that square in the middle, 25,000 square. And it says that alongside the holy district and the property of the city, on the west and on the east, corresponding in length to one of the tribal portions, that is extending from the river to the sea, extending from the western to the eastern boundary of the land. Verse 8, it is to be his property in Israel, and my princes shall no more oppress my people. The king shall no more oppress the common people, but they shall let the house of Israel have the land according to their tribes. The king has to be satisfied with this generous allotment of land given to him. And if you flip across to chapter 46, verse 16, you'll see there the other issue that I mentioned. Thus says the Lord God, if the prince makes a gift to any of his sons out of his inheritance, it shall belong to his sons. It is their property by inheritance. But if he makes a gift out of his inheritance to one of his servants, it shall be the servant's to the end of the year of liberty. Then it shall revert to the prince. Only his sons may keep the gift from his inheritance. The prince shall not take any of the inheritance of the people, thrusting them out of their property, and he shall give his sons their inheritance out of his own property, so that none of my people shall be dispossessed. So there you have those regulations to make sure that the royal family retained its land and to make sure that they didn't grab land that belonged to other people. And then you come to chapter 47. And here again we see a remarkable vision from Ezekiel. He sees a trickle of water coming out from beneath the altar. That is the altar of this temple. The temple, of course, is something he only sees in vision, and all of this that we're looking at here is a vision which the man has. And the trickle of water that he sees coming out is a miraculous trickle of water. It suddenly gets deeper and wider, deeper and wider, and within no time it's a mighty river. It's not fed by rain, it's not fed by streams or tributaries. It just increases miraculously. This vision is showing that the river of life is flowing from the throne of God, and it's going to bring healing to the people. As the river flows out, well, it's not a river, actually. It's only a trickle of water to start off with, but it very rapidly increases. We'll read it through and we'll get the picture. Chapter 47, verse 1. He brought me back to the door of the temple, and behold, water was issuing from below the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple faced east, and the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Notice that the water is flowing east and south, and at the end of verse 2 again, coming out on the south side. Now, if you look at the map, you'll see how that works out. The water is flowing east and south from the temple, and obviously it's heading towards the Dead Sea. That develops as you move on. You find in verse 3, going on eastward with the line in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits, that's about 500 meters, which isn't very far. Within 500 meters, the water from this little trickle was now ankle deep. Verse 4, another 500 meters, it's knee deep. Another 500 meters, it's up to his waist. And in verse 5, another 500 meters, and it's deep enough to swim in. Obviously, this is a supernatural stream. Then in verse 6, he led me back along the bank of the river. And verse 7, as I went back, I saw upon the bank of the river very many trees on the one side and on the other. He said to me, this water flows towards the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah. Now, the Arabah is the hot, dry valley through which the Jordan River flowed and in which the Dead Sea was situated. And it continued on down past the Dead Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba, which was on the northern tip of the Red Sea. So this stream is heading down southeast towards the Arabah, in fact, towards the Dead Sea, as you get later on in verse 8. When it enters the stagnant waters of the sea, the waters will become fresh. Now, we all know that the Dead Sea is called the Dead Sea because there's no life in it. The chemical content is so strong that it's not possible to maintain fish life there. But you see, even in the very valley of death, even in the place which is a pool of death, life comes. How does life come? Life comes because it comes from the throne of God. Now, that's the whole point of this. It's drawn upon by various other writers in the Bible. It's drawn upon particularly by John in the end of the book of Revelation. But the truth that is coming through is the truth that Jesus expressed when he spoke to a woman at a well in Samaria. And he said to this woman, whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him will never thirst. The water that I shall give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The life-giving water comes from God. Now, again, Jesus here is only giving an illustration. He wasn't there literally with water gushing out of him somewhere. But as with Ezekiel, so with Jesus, these are illustrations getting the point across. In another place, Jesus says this, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink, and out of his heart shall flow rivers of living water. Well, once again, not a literal river of living water any more than this one in Ezekiel. But this he said, speaking of the Spirit. And so the thrust of Ezekiel is the same as the thrust of the words of Jesus, and it's the same as the thrust of the words of John in the book of Revelation. And it is this, that here we have death, man hopeless, and yet in the place where death reigns supreme, the life of God flows and it brings life. And so the water comes out of the temple there and it flows down and it goes even to the Dead Sea, and lo and behold, the water becomes fresh. And it swarms with life. And in verse 9 it says, wherever the river goes, every living creature which swarms will live. And there'll be very many fish. What Ezekiel is getting across is simply the message of the gospel. It's as simple as that. The message of the gospel is this, that man by himself is hopeless. He is dead in sin and he cannot do anything to save himself. His position is virtually a write-off. But not entirely. Because God takes the initiative. And God says, I can bring life into the place where death reigns. And the life, of course, comes from the very throne of God. And so we find there that this life-giving stream flows down and it brings healing wherever it goes. We notice that in verse 12, the banks on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. And so it's not only giving life, it's giving nourishment. And that, again, is part of the gospel. It's not simply a case of being saved from hell. as if the gospel's a fire escape and that's it, we're saved from hell and we're safe now. Thank goodness for that. No, it's much more than that. It's nourishment as well, it's feeding so that we not only get the life, but now we grow in it. And we grow up to appreciate more and more of this marvellous life that God gives. And so there's the trees there on the sides of the river, and they give nourishment, they give food. Their leaves will not wither, their fruit will not fail, but they will bear fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Last words of verse 12. The water for them flows from the sanctuary, and the fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing. God's presence among his people brings life, brings healing, brings nourishment. And so man can now enjoy the paradise that had been denied back in Eden. When Adam sinned, that river of life, that tree of life was cut off from him, or he was cut off from it. But now we find that through the grace of God, there is the restoration, there is the healing, and it flows direct from the heart of God, direct from the throne of God to his needy people. That is really the climax of the book. It's a message of life. We saw it this morning, didn't we, in the dead bones. Well, the same thing again. There's that dead nation. But God gives life. And here again he's saying, to the dead, God will bring this life and vitality. However, there are a few more things to follow. Through the rest of chapter 47 and through into chapter 48, we have a lot of details concerning the division of the land that I have outlined on the map. The division between the 12 tribes and the division of this holy section and the section for the city. I'll just draw your attention to a couple of small details. In verse 14, for example, you shall divide it equally. There's the indication that the land was to be divided equally among the 12 tribes. And the rest of the chapter, on into the following chapter, details all the tribes and the different areas that they are to be given. You come to chapter 48, verse 15 through to verse 20, and that describes the division of the city portion. You see the city portion there with the city in the middle, square, and then on either side, land for the city. Well, I'm not going to go into all the details because you do get a bit bogged down with all the figures that are given there. And your minds will all be going around in circles as you're trying to add them all up. But I can assure you that if you do add them all up, they all work out evenly in the end. Ezekiel has done his sums correctly. If you come to verse 18, the very last words in verse 18 tell us that the land on either side of that city was produce for the food for the workers of the city. And then it moves on to talk about the city in greater detail, telling us in verse 30 to the end, that the city had 12 gates, and that there were 3 gates in each of the 4 walls. And the gates were named for the 12 tribes of Israel, telling us that the entire people of God are represented here in this city. And that again is the symbolism of it. And when you come to the book of Revelation, you find that John draws very heavily upon the symbolism of Ezekiel. Not only here, but a number of other issues that you've probably noticed by now. And then you come to the very final verse, in fact the very final words of the book of Ezekiel. The name of the city henceforth shall be, the Lord is there. And that is the heart of the message. God, we saw at the beginning, left his city, he left his sanctuary, but now he says, I'm bringing you back and I will come and dwell among you. The Lord, Jehovah, is there. The goal for the return of the people after the exile was to be to re-establish the nation, to re-establish the religious life according to God's perfect plan. But above all, the goal was that God wanted to dwell among his people forever. And as you read through the Bible, you find that that is exactly what God always wants to do. God desires fellowship with his people. He wants to live among his people. One of the sad things is that so often his people don't seem to appreciate his presence. You can go back to the beginning and you'll find, as you read the story of Moses setting up the tabernacle, that God said to him, I want you to build me a tabernacle so that I can dwell among my people. That was the main purpose, God living in fellowship with his own. And then the tabernacle was superseded by the temple. And then the temple was destroyed. and God symbolically departed. But now in Ezekiel we find he talks about the reconstruction of the nation and the rebuilding of the temple, and God is going to come, he says, and once again I want to dwell among my people. And you come to the New Testament and we find that in a very dramatic way God dwells among his people. They called his name Emmanuel, God with us. And so the people of God grew in the New Testament. And the temple that we referred to before came into being, a spiritual temple, a holy people. God again dwelling among his people, as we saw in Ephesians chapter 2, the verse that I quoted there, where God says, the people of God grow into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom also they are built together as a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. God wanting to dwell among his people. You come to almost the very final chapter of the Bible, and once again you find that the climax of that vision is, behold, the dwelling of God is with men. Always, God desires this fellowship with the creatures that he has put here on this earth. He desires that they come to know him and that they live in fellowship with him. And the tragedy is so often that we are like that church in the book of Revelation that I referred to yesterday, the church of Laodicea. And there was that church that had everything. The people were prosperous and they were secure. They had capabilities in many ways. And yet the Lord was not really among them, not truly among them, not spiritually, because they were all doing their own thing. They had got where they wanted to get in life, and so their spiritual life was rather flat, lukewarm, so much so that God said he couldn't stomach them any longer. And then you have that almost, you might say, pathetic picture of Jesus locked out of the church because they were so concerned with their own things that there was no real room for him. Again, God wanted to dwell among his people, but they weren't particularly keen on having him there because it interfered with their lifestyle. Oh yes, I know we believe God's among us and we have all our proof texts and we come to church and we sing songs and pray and do things like that. But really and truly, do we really want God among us? Or is it sometimes a bit of an embarrassment? Maybe he'll upset things that we want to do. Maybe it'll inconvenience us in some ways. And so sometimes there is just that feeling that we want to keep him at arm's length because we want to maintain our independence and we don't really want our comfortable lifestyle interfered too much with. That's a little bit like that church there in Laodicea. And so you have the Lord knocking on the door. He's locked outside the church. He wants to come in, but he keeps on knocking. And he says, look, I stand at the door and I knock. The church as a whole has locked me out. But if anyone hears, if any individual hears my voice and opens the door, well, I'll come into him and I'll eat with him and he with me. So he's saying to those people that even if the people as a whole don't want me, I am still available there to the faithful remnant, the faithful few, the genuine individuals here and there that really want me. And says the Lord to them, through John, as through Ezekiel, to the individual who turns to me and asks for my forgiveness and looks for my fellowship and is prepared to submit to my lordship, to that person I will indeed be Lord and friend, and I will come and dwell among them, and I will make my abode with him, and I'll feast with him and fellowship with him. I will be his God. They will be my people. That's the climax of Ezekiel. That's the great hope that the people look forward to. It's also the great challenge that you and I face. The Lord is there. Is he really? That's the question I think we have to ask ourselves. Apart from the proof texts and the theory, in practice, in my life, in my church, in my family, really, is the Lord there?